welcome back to Between Two Wings. I'm your host, Emily Norman, and today we have James Fallows with us, who is a well-known journalist. He is a contributing writer to The Atlantic, author of Breaking the News on Substack, and one of the best things is that he kind of ties his pilot experience and just, you know, his perspective on aviation into a lot of the work that he does. Jim, thanks so much for coming on Between Two Wings today.
Emily, I'm delighted to join you. Thanks very much.
Yeah, always great to have a fellow ForeFlight user on here as well. But, you know, we like to start off each episode with just kind of explaining what our backgrounds are. And mine looks a little bit odd if you just kind of look at just kind of some boats going around in circles. But one thing that really, you know, like nailed it down for me when we were talking last week was that, you know, aviation gives us a whole different perspective on places that we've been around for a long time, new places. I mean, you're literally seeing things from maybe 3,000 feet. And so this is a town that I actually grew up and currently live in again today, and it's a fishing town. And I've always saw the boats go in and out. I reap the benefits of really fresh seafood, but I'd never actually seen how these delights were ever harvested. So one morning I woke up really early, went out over the bay, and unintentionally found all these oyster boats going around and around and around. And, you know, just one of those different perspectives. And I think that's what makes us fall in love with aviation, but also stay in love with aviation. But you've got some pretty mountains behind you, a great plane. Tell me about that.
So the picture, so Emily, again, thanks for that story. I hadn't heard your story about the oyster beds, but that perfectly encapsulates the aerial view, which uniquely general aviation pilots have. And then we're really fortunate to do so. So the view behind me is, and it's the airport in San Bernardino, California, which is inland Southern California. When I was growing up nearby in the town of Redlands, this was known as Norton Air Force Base. And it was where B-52s were based. It has this gigantic runway, 12,000 feet long or something like that. And 5 years ago, my wife, Deb, and I flew our little Cirrus from DC, where we have been based for a long time, out to San Bernardino so we could spend the next couple of months in my hometown of Redlands, right, writing the book Our Towns, which was based on the previous 4 or 5 years of traveling around the country in the Cirrus you see behind us, a 435 Sierra Romeo. Now looks different because of a new paint job, but the plane lived there at San Bernardino Airport with the beautiful mountains behind it while we were nearby in Redlands doing our writing. So this is to me the view of home, what you see in this beautiful picture from Southern California.
And, you know, touching on what you did with Our Towns, you guys flew around and you wrote this book. And then last year you guys had a HBO documentary come out. You know, so there's multiple ways for people to kind of get an inside look at what Our Towns is. But what was the purpose behind it, and how did aviation come into play there?
So aviation was central to this project. And the brief version of the origin story is that Deb and I have lived outside the U.S. a lot for many, many years. And from 2006 until about 2011, we were mainly in China. And when we were in China, we were going outside the big cities to see little towns, that is only a couple million in China, and tell their story. And we returned to the U.S. We thought we had this tool of general aviation to allow us to do something similar in the U.S., to be able to go to places that usually were not in the news unless there was a tornado or a natural disaster or the Iowa caucuses or something. And so we began using the tool of our little plane to go. I think we went initially to Red Oak, Iowa. Then we went to Rock Springs, Wyoming, went to a number of other places, again, that normally wouldn't be in the news, and asked people, what is going on here that you don't hear reported normally on TV or from the major media? And this became so absorbing that we ended up spending, again, about 4 years doing hundreds and hundreds of articles for The Atlantic. We did a book called Our Towns and eventually a movie. And its main message was the places you don't hear about that much in the U.S., what is the view like from there, as opposed to just dropping in for one day and going to a diner, but spending a week or two and saying, what's the story of this town?
Yeah, no, that's incredible. And I think this might have been something that was easier done because you did have a plane to fly around, but you probably could have accomplished the same goal driving in your car as well. Just maybe not as quick and as exciting from a camera's perspective.
Well, it is true that one of the reasons I have loved being a pilot in the past 25 years since I've had a certificate and the many decades before that in which I've been fascinated by aviation is the particular view of the landscape, especially the American landscape, you have from a couple thousand feet up, where you can see the logic of towns and where mm-hmm. they are and why they are on rivers or in mountain ranges or in passes or whatever. So we had that sense of the logic of the American landscape. And also, there are a lot of places that are a whole lot easier to get to if you have the privilege of general aviation than if you're on some interstate, and where America looks a lot more homogenized from an interstate than it does mm-hmm. In the way that you and I are able to visit towns.
Yeah, definitely. Very fortunate to do that for sure. So kind of rewinding 20 years now, you have a book called Free Flight, which was completely fascinating. A lot of things I kind of witnessed or kind of learned about over the past few years, but you're writing this in the early 2000s when GA was losing popularity. We were really stuck in a time warp, still kind of are to some perspective, but there's been a lot of technological advances. What are some of the changes that you have appreciated since that book was released in the early 2000s until now?
So that was, thanks for mentioning that. That was a book that came out, I think it came out in the summer of 2001. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that timing because in the fall of 2001, many things changed in the travel world and the international world and everything else. And its argument was that in the previous couple of years, when I'd been doing a lot of general aviation flying, all in rented aircraft, in 172s and 182s and Cherokees and the rest, I'd been following avidly the aviation press, hearing about Cirrus, which was coming up with this new airplane that was supposed to revolutionize things, about Lance Air doing something similar in Oregon, about the nascent Eclipse company, which was going mm-hmm. to have point-to-point travel. And essentially, I was saying, we all recognize that commercial aviation, for all of its virtues, commercial airlines, for all of their virtues, safety above all, and the ways in which they can go around the weather in a way that I can't do in the Cirrus, of kind of the break point of inconvenience and harassment and congestion that was coming with the hub and spoke model. So I was saying there are people who are pioneering a new way. If you can have point-to-point travel, you can have a safer way of having your own pilot flown travel. And so it was about Bruce Holmes, who was working at NASA, and the Klapmeyer brothers at Cirrus, and about Vern Rayburn, others at Eclipse, and about other people were saying there should be a way to use the advanced technology of point-to-point aviation to allow people to have much more efficient travel and to connect places that are off the grid of the hub and spoke. So that was the sort of the dawn of the new era I was talking about in 2001. That went through a lot of security-induced problems for the previous, succeeding 8 or 10 years. But I think we now see this coming back into prominence.
Yeah, and it's probably been incredible to see all those little changes come to light and, you know, make flying not only safer, but just easier and more enjoyable. You can plan a flight in less than an hour and safely and efficiently do it as well. So lots of changes there.
Oh, it is incredible, just to vamp on this theme for a second, the mm-hmm. convenience, safety, and awareness you have now. I use ForeFlight essentially 20 hours a day when I'm preparing for a flight or doing it. I have it on my iPad. But the idea that you can see other traffic and you can see real-time weather. When I did my instrument training and check rise back in Seattle in the late 1990s, you had to do actual NDB approaches, which no one has ever heard of these days. And it just, the way in which you have almost a God's eye view of the universe through ForeFlight, through the other tools in the cockpit, mm-hmm. it is something that airline pilots would have just, would barely have dreamed of until recently.
Yeah, definitely. And like on that note, you hear all the time that they're phasing out more VORs and things are still actively changing. And that'll be really interesting. Of course, that's not going to happen before my instrument check ride, but you know, it's all fine.
it's good to know when I do my yearly instrument proficiency checks, which I do for insurance purposes and on good mm-hmm, practice, yeah. We always do VOR approaches. We don't do NDB approaches anymore because I'm mm-hmm. not even aware of any that exist here in DC.
Yeah, definitely. And then also, you know, for on our side, the enjoyment and the technology has been really helpful to just grow the interest in aviation and make it easier, like we've been saying, for pilots. But what about the people who aren't even in this world at all? Has there been perception changes from the past 20 years towards general aviation?
So I think that there's been one notable perception change I've seen that as I mentioned, I've always been interested in aviation. I've always looked for ways that I could fly around with people even before I could fly myself. And the general public's sense was to overstate it. Oh, this is a death trap. You know, that there are so many famous entertainers in the 1950s and 1960s had perished in small plane crashes. And there have been another of other notable ones. And I think the idea, it is sinking into people of the safety factors that redundancy of information and weather planning, which of course is the main factor in the safety of aviation, and a parachute and ways to see other traffic. And all these things have, I have noted in my own life, people thinking, gee, I now begin to understand the redundancies and the cushions and the safeties, the way in which an inherently challenging activity is able to take advantage of technology to make itself safer and more robust and more predictable, and especially about weather. You know, weather is the, I think every pilot knows, and most non-pilots don't know, how much weather equals aviation safety for general aviation. So the knowledge you have about weather via modern tools, including ForeFlight, is just a complete transformation.
Absolutely. There is no doubt that flying has become much safer, and it's really good to see the interest overall in aviation grow. So we've touched a little bit on how you've incorporated aviation into your own work with Free Flight and Our Towns, but I want to talk about how you did this in your book, China Airborne. These topics don't really seem like the obvious pair.
So thanks for asking about that book, which is actually one of the favorites that I have done. And and the brief backstory there, there's two brief backstories. One is, when I moved to China in 2006, I imagined then that I'd be able to do a fair amount of serious flying in China. Ha, 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 ha. And the reason is the military still controls virtually every inch of airspace in China. And in the U.S., we know where military zones are. And most airspace is not military. It's the reverse in China. Most airspace is military. And that means, so I did two flights in a Cirrus in China. It was so risky, as I describe in the book, that I decided I would declare victory. And not do any more than that. The other reason the other backstory is that China is so vast that if you're going to write about it, you have to either choose the big overview, here's a 1,000-page book about the history of China, or you choose one thing as a microcosm. And I chose the prospect for aerospace in China as the microcosm, because I think everything about China's potential, both the things it can achieve and its limits, and its relationships with the rest of the world for better and for worse, you can tell in the story of its ambition to have its own aerospace industry. Because to have a really effective aerospace industry, you have to do lots of things at once. Government has to work with business. There has to be a real safety culture. You need ways to sort of to integrate universities and businesses. And it just requires, it's something that if you have advanced aerospace, you have a million other things too. And China has been trying to do that. And I think it still is a path ahead, even though the Chinese aerospace ministry now owns the Cirrus company.
Yeah. Well, maybe you'll get a few more Cirrus flights in China one day.
Let me hope that works out. The first five pages of the book describe a flight that I feel fortunate to have survived in central China. But I'll leave that to the imagination.
Yeah, no spoiler alerts here. Yeah, and I think one thing kind of goes back to Free Flight a little bit, but you had mentioned how the aviation system, it makes a lot of sense, but I kind of had to have it laid out for me. But we have the most like checks and balances in any really like standardized system, like, you know, even down to the student pilot, to the FAA and everyone in between that, you know, signs off on a private pilot's license. Everyone's getting checked. People are getting checked. The aircrafts are getting checked. The airspace regulations, how can we make this more efficient?
Well, I appreciate your mentioning that. And I think that for those of us in the piloting world, we can appreciate simultaneously the spontaneity and the freedom that is in the piloting world. Mm-hmm. I think civilians are often amazed that outside really regulated airspace, like where I live in DC, but in most of the country, you can just drive to the airport and take off and you can go where you want and you don't need to have a reservation where you're going to land, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, like the freedom of driving. That is something we take for granted. And it is possible because of all the things that are so tightly disciplined. I said both regulated and disciplined, but you have these cultures of safety in the manufacturers and in the federal and state authorities and in the piloting culture and all the rest. And I think that it's something that is a real achievement. I'll mention one other thing, that the gold standard for understanding how systems fail is the NTSB report. I did an article for The Atlantic actually a year ago saying, if we viewed pandemic response the way the NTSB would view it, what would be the chain of causation we found? So I think that American pilots, I say American as opposed to North American, may take for granted both what is available to us here in terms of still the airports that are around and the freedom to fly and the way the culture has evolved to make it, again, an inherently perilous activity, as safety conscious and safe as it is.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely incredible. It kind of surprises me every single day of how it has stayed the way it is, and the community down to the people and just every aspect. It's so unique. And I'm sure you feel this way too, but I'm just really lucky to be a part of it.
So I'm by trade a writer. I've spent almost all my adult life as a writer for magazines or books or whatever. When flying was being invented 100 years ago, it was like a million times more perilous than it is right now. There was the idea then that anybody who was a writer or an artist or a poet or a philosopher or a historian or anybody advanced would want to be a pilot because of this unique in human history view that you can have from two or three thousand feet up. I still feel that every day.
Yeah. And so going off of that, what are some of the similarities to, these worlds, and then also, how you approach both types of tasks?
So I think there's something that is similar between the flying world and my day job of writing that I take seriously, and something that's very different that I take seriously too. The part that's similar is seeing connections and patterns. For example, when you're flying up and down the East Coast, say in the fall, you can see the succession of colors in the trees. They're changing color, from green to yellow to red. Or in the spring, as you go south, you can see the fields becoming greener as crops are ripening. If you fly along the Appalachians, you can see the passes where people went through, and you can see the waterfalls where mill towns developed. And you can just essentially, from my point of view, you can see American history unfolding beneath you as you fly from north to south or east to west. I like doing those connections in my writing. I like seeing them from flying. The part that's different is that I love the proceduralism of flying, of making sure there is the checklist every time and asking yourself, what is the flow inside the cockpit, the checklist, and then the flow of how's the mixture and where are the flaps and is everything ready? And the just very, very careful checklist driven sense of what comes next, living in the now and thinking about this moment and 5 minutes from now and 10 minutes from now. That's different from the writing world. But I like the combination of intellectually, it's like writing, procedurally, it's very different. And I appreciate both of those things.
You're talking a lot about the checklist and the processes. Have you implemented any of those kind of aspects into the way you approach? If you're just sitting down and going to write for some project or anything?
It's sort of yes, mainly no.
Yeah.
the sort of yes, there's a kind of consciousness of procedure that you get from flying, which affects everything else you do. Mm-hmm. And just, thinking of instrument procedures and all the rest, the mainly no is that usually when I'm writing, if I'm writing a book, I view that as kind of hard writing where you do a sentence 20 or 30 different times before it's the way you want. You can't really do that on an instrument approach, but it is. So I view them as different even though proceduralism of flying probably has affected my attempts to organize my life.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. I think I'm going to stick to reading your books and not try to get into the writing cycle. So I know you were the chief speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. You've flown on Air Force One. I have to ask, what was that like?
So there's one thing that makes flying on Air Force One different, I believe, from any other kind of flying that exists, even if you're a billionaire with a fleet of private jets, even if you're a military pilot or whatever. And I'm not talking about all the command post that's built in there. I'm not talking about the little name tags everybody has when they get on. I'm talking about the fact that you load up a plane, everybody gets on there before the president, and the president walks up the steps. And the instant the president gets in his seat and puts on his seatbelt, the plane goes, you know, just starts taxiing the instant his butt is in the chair. And I don't think they're, obviously, that's not the case with the airlines. Mm-mm. You know, don't get us started. It's not the case in our own plane where you're still 15 or 20 minutes of getting things going. But that sense of the president gets on the plane and you go. That really, yeah. And there's not even delay at the end of the runway. You taxi and you take the runway and you go. So that is something that is impressive. Before that, on Carter's campaign in 1976, I rode for a while on the so-called Peanut One. Jimmy Carter was a peanut farmer from Georgia. There was a chartered United plane called Peanut One. And often I would go up in the cockpit with the pilots, which you could do in those days, and watch, especially on landings. And I had never before in my life seen the way an approach looks from the front of the plane. Because in an airliner, mm-hmm. you're always looking as a passenger boringly out the side. But to be able to see the 3D-ness of an approach, you know, turning, going on downwind and basin landing, just seeing the ballet, the three-dimensional ballet that the pilots were doing as the runway came into view. That was the first time I'd seen it from an airliner, and I'd been hooked, especially from then on.
Yeah, no, definitely. That would do it for me as well. I would love to see that one day. Well, Jim, thanks so much for coming on Between Two Wings. It's been great to talk to you, and I can't wait to read more of the things that you write and how you tie it together with aviation. Truly a pleasure. So thank you so much.
Emily, thanks so much. The pleasure is mine to have a chance to join you.
Well, thank you. And everyone, thank you so much for tuning into this episode Between Two Wings. We'll see you next time.